This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Senator Barack Obama, now President Barack Obama, President-elect. We reached a historic milestone. We really, really have. Chris Crum is with us, and Chris is the executive director of the Institute of Southern Studies and publisher of Southern Exposure.
But first,
I'm extremely pleased to be joined now by someone who can help put it in a context for us, and Professor Eric Fona, who's a professor at Columbia University and really one of the country's most prominent historians, whose most recent book is Our Lincoln, New Perspectives on Lincoln and His World. And this is particularly interesting as we approach the bicentennial in February 2009 of Lincoln. Well, Professor Fona joins us now. And indeed, how long and how do we analyze this remarkable win of President-elect Barack Obama?
You know, I mean, I suppose in a way every cliche has already been said on television, but it is still important to step back and say this is a really remarkable thing given the long trajectory of racism in America. You know, slavery is a long time ago, 150 years or something, but certainly racism and segregation and denial of the right to vote is not so long ago. You know, 50 years ago, blacks could not vote in many states in this country. When Barack Obama's parents got married, their marriage was illegal in quite a few states because, quote-unquote, miscegenation was still banned until the Supreme Court in the late 60s overturned that. And needless to say, there is still great inequality in this country. So, you know, but the fact that a black man could be elected president is a very remarkable thing. And, you know, from a historical point of view, to show you how remarkable it is, just think of the fact that in all of American history, since George Washington, you know, there have been only 5 black members of the U.S. Senate, including Obama. There have been only 4 black governors of any state. So getting into those higher offices, I'm not talking about members of Congress, most of whom represent basically black districts. I'm not talking about mayors of cities, often with significant black populations. But to get to those offices where you really have to rely on a large white vote has been virtually impossible for blacks until this very moment. So it is a really remarkable thing.
Eric, I'm, you know, one of the things you've written a lot about and is my favorite period in history, much maligned, and that is Reconstruction. You call it America's unfinished revolution, 1863, 1877. And I see it within that context of really almost taking up and continuing that remarkable period. And I was hoping that you could elaborate on that somewhat.
Well, I agree with you. In a way, it's too bad that Frederick Douglass and Thaddeus Stevens and Wendell Phillips and all those great Americans from that period somehow couldn't live, of course, to see this day. But Reconstruction, right after the Civil War, was the moment when, for the first time, this country tried to really be a democracy. That is to say, to extend the rights of citizens, the right to vote, the right to hold office, civil rights, etc., to black Americans, the vast majority of whom had just been freed during the Civil War. And it rewrote our Constitution. You know, without Reconstruction, we would not be here today. The 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, civil rights laws of that period, which are still on the books, and in some ways equally or more powerful than the famous laws passed during the 1960s. Of course, it didn't succeed in the sense of becoming permanent. It was reversed. It was followed by the long, long era of white supremacy, segregation, Jim Crow. But Reconstruction established this principle of equal rights for all, which had never existed before the Civil War, and it put it into our Constitution. And so, in a way, we are seeing the second coming of Reconstruction, in a way. So I, you know, as a scholar of that period, I think it's, you know, that makes it even more significant to me.
And I just want to take it up to your book, Our Lincoln, New Perspectives. where does it fit into this? I have this vision still of the inauguration happening in proximity to the monument of Abraham Lincoln.
Right,
I understand there were many contradictions about Lincoln, but I'm interested in how you look at the Obama election and what it potentially means and where it might fit into that perspective on new perspectives on Lincoln.
Right. Well, you know, Obama began his campaign, seems like a long time ago now, in Springfield, Illinois. I mean, he chose that because that is the home of Lincoln. That's where Lincoln was buried. You know, Lincoln is a very complicated figure in our history. You know, he's a figure of his time, of the 19th century. He was not a god. He was not perfect. You know, no human being is. And I think, in a way, some of the books on Lincoln do him a disservice by exalting him into such a position of perfection that it's almost inevitable that the next historian is going to come and tear him down, you know. But Lincoln was a great man who faced enormous challenges. He was a product of his time. He shared many of the racial prejudices of his time, but he managed to outgrow at least some of them. He always hated slavery, but he, until quite late in his life, he really could not conceive of America as a biracial society. He never gave any serious thought until toward the very end of the Civil War as to what place black people would have in this country once slavery was ended. And but at the very end, he did realize that this was going to have to be a society which was, you know, was biracial. He had an older idea of shipping blacks out of the country, trying to find another place for them to live. But he eventually came to realize this was not happening. And the very, very end of his life, he was then talking about the right to vote for some of the former slaves. So the greatness of Lincoln is his evolution, his ability to rise to the occasion, the fact that, unlike, let us say, our most recent president, he wasn't stubborn, stuck in his ways, unwilling to listen to criticism. And he learned from people like Frederick Douglass and from abolitionists and from black and white who he, you know, who he met and talked to and listened to. So, you know, I hope that's the essence of greatness, you know, the ability to rise to the occasion. Now, Obama will come into office not quite in the crisis that Lincoln did, but still in a pretty serious situation for this country. And, you know, I hope he also has the capacity to rise to the occasion. He has a tremendous burden, but he also has a tremendous opportunity to really reshape this country in significant ways, and he's been given a mandate to do that.
And what does this specific moment mean? I keep going back to a lot of the things, again, your articles and the thoughts on Reconstruction and the thousands of men and women who have served in the Senate or as governors since the ratification of our Constitution. Nine only have been African American. How monumental, how important is this? How potential,
potential
exists for realignment of forces within the South?
You know, it is a reflection of what has happened in this society since the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, one of the things, Obama is a new generation. He's a younger man. I mean, you know, he's much younger than I am. He did not live through the 60s. He is building on the changes that took place in the 1960s. This is not a society in which race is irrelevant. We have not moved beyond race, as some people say. And yet, race is far more complicated today than it was in those older days where, the old black-white template no longer really describes race in America. You know, there's a much broader spectrum of racial configuration now. And younger people really don't see race in the way that my generation and people before them did. You know, it's just not the critical element in dealing with other people. Again, I don't want to get into this the mode that a lot of newspaper pundits are now saying, you know, okay, race is irrelevant from now on. That is really not the case in this country. But on the other hand, it is not, yes, now it may not be the single critical factor in how people think of themselves. But, you know, we have, in looking as a historian, maybe it has never been totally that. You know, there are many instances in our history of black and white people working together for common goals. The abolitionist movement did that in the 19th century. The labor movement, which was probably the most integrated racially integrated social movement of the 20th century brought people of all backgrounds together for the common goal. This doesn't mean that they loved one another. They were dancing cheek to cheek, you know. But they were able to say, look, we have interests, we have goals, we have aspirations, and we're willing to work together for those goals. And Obama put together a electoral majority who said the same thing. You know, look, this guy is black. That's not the main issue facing the country today, whether he's black or white. We got so many problems that we've got to choose the person who can best address the situation of the country. So to that extent, it represents a minimization, you might say, of race as the most salient characteristic of people. And I think that's, of course, a very good thing. But there are precedents for it in the past.
The precedents, maybe I want to get to the more recent past, and I couldn't help but be moved as I looked at the tears that formed in the eyes of Jesse Jackson, the tears indeed that were on the face of Congressman John Lewis, who was at the Edmund Pettus Bridge and was beaten so brutally as people were trying so desperately to accomplish their the franchise. What does it mean when you look at the Fannie Lou Hamers, when you look at the Medgar Evers, the Viola Liusos, the Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, all so very recent?
Well, these are martyrs, you know, and there's some of the ones you mentioned, of course, died in the struggle. Some are still around, like John Lewis. And, of course, as Frederick Douglass said many, many years ago, power never concedes anything without a struggle. And this was the struggle of the 60s. And, you know, Obama is a very, very intelligent guy, and he understands that. He understands that without that struggle, he could never have gotten to where he is now. Nonetheless, even though I'm a historian, there is no point in becoming so immersed in that history that you kind of fail to look forward. You know what I mean? We need to know our history, and one of the problems of this country is a kind of historical amnesia in certain ways. On the other hand, we shouldn't become so obsessed with history that we are not able to recognize change and progress. And there has been enormous progress in the area of race and the area of equal rights, not total by any stretch of the imagination, but we're in a different place in terms of those issues today than we were when John Lewis and others had to be marching, you know, were marching for the right to vote and were assaulted by the police down in Alabama. So that's good. You know, I mean, we should accept progress when we find it.
Well, I want to thank you for spending some time with us this morning. It is a great morning. It is a period that historians will...
It's a historical moment, and we should savor it before waking up after a few more days and saying, boy, this guy's got a lot of problems to deal with. I wish him a lot of luck, you know.
Well, we're going to be there with him because the fact of the matter is we have to become the driving force and still...
Well, we do, and we have to make sure that we support him when he does the right thing and criticize him when he doesn't do the right thing and urge him to keep in mind that he was elected to bring change to this country. And if he tries to be like Clinton, you know, and triangulate and make deals with everybody and pick up the positions of his enemy, of his opposition, he's not going to get anywhere. And I think many, many people will feel deeply betrayed if he turns out to just be politics as usual. I hope and expect that won't happen. But the people who supported him have to keep the pressure on to make sure that he really is an agent of change.
Professor Eric Foner, professor at Columbia University, and I encourage all of our listeners to get our Lincoln New Perspectives on Lincoln and the World. And one of my favorite writers and editors is Eric Foner.
Well, thank you.
Always has much to offer. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, a pleasure to talk to you.
Amanecer, López, a la luz de la aurora, lo que tanto aclamamos, la noche al caer, sus estrellas.
Just wanted to play a little bit Nuestro Himno, the Star Spangled Banner, by that compilation of voices, the sense of diversity and potential that was part of the coalition and the electorate that put into office now Senator Barack Obama, now President-elect. And to continue our discussion, Chris Crum, the executive director of the Institute of Southern Studies and publisher of Southern Exposure, and I am delighted to have you with us. And what I want to know is, does this begin to create a realignment in the South? Goodness, you know, I watched Pennsylvania come in, I watched Ohio come in, and Florida, and then began to see a kind of infiltration of areas of the South that we have not touched for a long time. And I want to understand what that means. And thanks for joining us, Chris.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Are you happy?
Oh, well, it's absolutely astounding. I think that it's not just that you have the first African-American president in our country's history, but that he was helped greatly towards that conclusion by three Southern states. Helping give him that victory. And it's just, you know, on the last day before the elections, he went to Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. Those are the places he campaigned last to make his case, and it seems to have worked. And in his speech, he brought out the story of the 106-year-old woman in Georgia who had seen the changes in the South, and I think he was speaking to something there about that there is a different South emerging, that this could shake up politics in the region for years to come.
And how would you expect it to realign? I mean, is it something substantive? Is it something that we haven't been seeing, the changing composition, the nature of Latino activity and vote that has moved into southern region as well?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when the polls were showing that these three southern states were really moving in Obama's direction, one of the first things that the outgoing senator of Virginia, John Warner, said was like, well, North Carolina, Virginia, and Florida, those are different than the rest of the South. And you just wonder how many states are going to keep adding to that list that are supposedly different than the South to kind of dismiss them because, on the contrary, these states actually symbolize the direction that the entire South is headed. It's becoming a younger region, it's becoming a more urban region, and as you're pointing to, it's becoming a more racially diverse region. Four out of five of the states in the country that have the fastest growing Latino population in the nation are in the South. States like North Carolina, obviously Florida, even Georgia, which even though Obama didn't win there, the fact is millions of people in that state voted for this new Obama in that state. And so it really does signal that there is a different South. A lot of people's ideas about what the South is are really rooted in an older version of what the South is. And there is a different South emerging. So whether or not that means a president like Obama could win again in these states in 2012, you know, who knows? But we do know that this is the direction the region is moving.
I know I was disappointed, but not unexpectedly, about Louisiana, which did go for McCain. And does that mean that what has been accomplished there is what many of us feared, which is really a whitening of Louisiana, that there is the forced and permanent removal of many of the groups that have been there traditionally?
Oh, there's no question that played a big factor in Louisiana. When you had a city like New Orleans, which is, you know, about 30% of the population still hasn't returned, you had massive purging of the voter rolls, which is a major civil rights issue that still needs to be addressed. The fact that not just from Hurricane Katrina, but from Hurricanes Ike and Gustav, you know, tens of thousands of people who were uprooted and displaced and still had to worry about where their registrations were, where they could vote. Some 21,000 people were sliced from the rolls just this year in Louisiana. That sort of thing makes a huge difference, and it's a major civil rights issue. But that's another state where the long-term trend, I just don't think that you're going to be able to fight that back, which is, it's a region that if more of these people, the African-American population, is able to come back, you know, as of their rights, and also dramatically growing Latino population, that's another state. It's just like the rest of the South. It's moving in a direction that does signal a new coalition, a new majority that's forming in the South that's going to change politics.
So let's be more specific to get into that, since this is something you really study. What would reform kind of mean? What are some of the problems, and how do you see kind of coalescing around reform, and of what sort?
In terms of like a political agenda? In the region. I mean, I think what you're really finding is there's a new majority that is willing to work together around, one issue I'll just bring forward right now is, you know, reforming of the elections. It's just that it's been taking years to try to make it able so more people can participate in democracy. And I think that's another lesson from this, is that you had even things like early voting, but also we had same-day registration in North Carolina. These are things that allowed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands more people to participate and scaled back some of the disenfranchisement that we've seen historically in the South, although that's not to say there weren't a lot of problems still. But there's a pro-democracy agenda there. But then moving even beyond that, you know, the economic crisis was so critical to what happened in a lot of these southern states, in states especially like North Carolina. And I think there's a real kind of potential now to start uniting people around these common class and economic justice issues, which just affect so many people in the South, have the highest rates of poverty, the most struggling schools. These are the kind of issues that you really can build a new majority around.
As I look at the face of Congressman John Lewis and remembered the Edmund Pettus Bridge and remembered the level of disenfranchisement in conjunction with the incredible poverty of states like Mississippi, etc., is this as momentous as I believe it is, as I feel it is, the election of Obama and what it can mean to begin to organize against the right to work issues within the South and so on?
You know, I really think so. And what was so interesting talking to people as these results were coming in, you know, you had age, of course, was a huge issue in this election.
Just that
there's a whole younger generation of Southerners who were very much willing to embrace a new direction for politics. And in every southern state, when you get below like the 30-year-old range, they were going for Obama, right? So we have a whole new generation. And the South is becoming a younger region. You know, the demographic shift isn't just along race lines, but it's also around age. And so it's a younger region that there is a shift in that direction. But when you also then, of course, talk to people, the old civil rights veterans I was talking to, you know, who just were absolutely overwhelmed, that they just really never thought they'd see the day. And everything that they'd fought and struggled for, and still are fighting and struggling for, it's not like the movement ever really died for lots of people, that this was just momentous. And so you had, in a way, you kind of saw what this coalition looks like. It's these people who have fought, and there is this deep tradition of struggle and progressive change in the South. From generations, and that older generation is still here and still fighting. And then you have a newer generation, a broad swath of people who are looking at politics in a new way in the South, and that really gives you a sense of what this new majority can look like.
Well, Chris, I most certainly want to give people information about where they can read A Southern Exposure and find out more about the work of the Institute of Southern Studies, which is constant and good. And the change is going to sculpt for us a very different kind of country and begin to balance forces in a really important way. And we hope move towards wealth distribution and egalitarianism, which really is a major objective. So where can people find out more about the organization and get your writings?
Well, I'll just say, too, that the Institute was founded by John Lewis and Julian Bond in 1970 and civil rights veterans. So in a way, we're an example of what this is all about.
It's really a homecoming.
It really is a multi-generational center that believes that we is working for a changing and a better South. And you can find us at southernstudies.org and our daily blog, which has daily updates on what this all means. We're going to be looking at that from a variety of different angles, having people like Representative Lewis speak about it at southernstudies.org /facingsouth, which is our daily blog, and we invite people to come and be part of the conversation about what a new South can look like.
Chris Crum, thanks for helping to shape that new South and spending time with us both.
Right.
It's been
great. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Hate to see the nation be run by a hack. Dig the situation that he dug in Iraq. Half the population wants to give him the sack. Now he's looking around for someone else to attack. We need somebody great to get us back on the track. So we're taking it back with Barack. Jack, choo-choo, change to believing, woo-woo. We can achieve it, choo-choo, change to believing, taking it back with Barack, Jack.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.
New administration needs the guts to enact. Drastic legislation leave the planet intact. We can't be messing around with some Republican Mac, so we're taking it back with Barack, Jack. Choo-choo, change to believing, woo-woo. We can achieve it, choo-choo, change to believing, taking it back with Barack, Jack.